Ah, you came back. Well, obviously I did too. We better watch out. This could become a habit. And if you're tuning in for the first time, you might want to treat yourself to a flashback. I'm sure as hell not going to catch you up. Matt Mittler here, and you're listening to episode 2 of Sunday Night Noir. We'll be continuing with Kaufman's Holiday, Part 1, Pagan Rites, and picking things up with Chapter 8. Fry was detritus, but he'd confirmed Kaufman's suspicion that Patrick Walsh was something less than a hero. Now to talk to somebody who'd been there in the winner's circle. He pulled up his cuff and glanced at the Tissot, his only possession of any value. Used to pick it up at his father's shop, rock it back and forth, feel the self-winding mechanism whir. One day, near the end of his 12th year, it was sitting in a box on his dresser with a note. "Because you're a good boy, chick." His father probably never would have given it to him if he'd known he was going to buck his bar mitzvah. He shook his wrist, giving the gears an extra go. 4:10 in the afternoon. Time to pay a visit to Bradley Glen. Kaufman found a payphone across the street inside the A&P. He ran his finger along the names in the book. There were two Glens, one on Potter Street and one on Eustace. Potter seemed the obvious choice, but the number belonged to a widow with no kids. She gave him an earful of sorrow and cost him 2 coins. He promised to pay her a visit some day. The Eustace address placed the other Glen out past K Street. Didn't really make sense. It was the outskirts of town, beyond the estates, shoddy shacks by the beach. Did Bradley slum? No point wasting another nickel. He caught a bus on Broadway, hopped off at Bliss, and walked the rest of the way. It was one of those two-family abodes divided down the middle. Bit of rolling lawn in front and sweeping weeping willow round back. A bunch of kids were tearing after each other, shouting, "Pow, you're dead!" Raggedy little creatures, runny noses, scabby knees. One boy pointed a stick at Kaufman, and he held up his hands. "I surrender."
"Pal!"
The kid shot him anyway. Kaufman staggered up the steps. With his last ounce of strength, he rang the doorbell.
"I'm so sorry. Are the children bothering you?"
She was younger than he imagined, especially with a dozen kids. "Just a flesh wound, ma'am. I think it'll heal." He held out his hand. "Mrs. Glen?"
"Yes,"
she answered skeptically. "Name's Mo Koffler." Decided to go with a goy moniker this time. "I'm with Look Magazine." He gave her his most ingratiating smile. She dried her palms on a daisied apron and offered him a firm shake.
"We don't need a subscription, thank you."
No, I'm sorry. We're doing a piece on Private Patrick Walsh. Trying to make a nice spread for the lad. Talk to his friends, round it out."
"Oh, I see."
She stepped out and let the tattered screen door slam behind her.
"Da-da-da! I killed it, you!"
It was the little warrior again.
"Wayne, I'm having a conversation."
"Nobody's plays by the rules,"
he began to wail. "Must be frustrating," offered Kaufman sympathetically.
"Peggy, Darlene!"
2 older girls appeared from under a white sheet on the clothesline, rushed out and whisked away their sibling. For barbaric medical treatment, no doubt. Kaufman felt sorry for the lad. Nobody's does plays by the rules. He addressed his hostess, who now appeared to be suffering an instant migraine, her head ticking to the side.
"Anyhow, Mrs. Glen, I was wondering if it would be possible to speak with your son."
"Bradley?"
"Bingo." "Yes, ma'am. Is he around?"
She sucked in a short breath.
"I'm sorry. He's out. He's probably at Horizon House."
Not quite the response Kaufman expected.
"May I ask when he's due home?"
A swell of screams and giggles rolled out from the hospital tent.
"He isn't, Mr. Koffler. He leads his own life. I'm sure he's a huge help to Mr. Walsh at this time.
The children were suddenly quiet. Mrs. Glynn leaned out over the railing, tried to catch a glimpse of whatever unmentionable acts were occurring between the sheets.
Have you spoken to Clayton yet?
No, ma'am. I thought it would be best to hold for a while.
That would be the sensitive thing to do.
Mrs. Glynn looked down at her scuffed crepe-soled sandals.
You could try calling on Bradley over there, but I wouldn't hope for much.
Thanks. I'll give it a whirl. In the meantime, Mrs. Glynn, would you mind sharing a few words for our magazine?
Please, make yourself comfortable, Mr. Koffler. Would you like some iced tea?
Kaufman removed his hat and swung it listlessly by his side. The braided rug under his feet was littered with toys. Dingy green drapes muffled the light, but not enough to hide the worn upholstery of the second-hand furniture and the peeling floral wallpaper. Felt like home. On a dusty console radio, Guy Lombardo conducted a swinging beat. Tuesday. Damn, he'd missed Jack Benny two Sundays in a row.
Tea would be swell. Thanks.
He avoided the sagging couch and sat in a tufted armchair, springs poking up into his backside. Mrs. Glynn returned with a pitcher and two mismatched aluminum glasses. She moved briskly, her wide eyes darting about as if she'd forgotten something urgent. She was small but not frail, and had probably once been attractive. Kaufman noticed she'd removed the apron and managed to slap on some lipstick while getting their drinks. She poured for both of them. No ice, but it didn't matter.
You'll have to excuse this place, Mr. Koffler. We're not used to guests.
A freckled-faced gunslinger came racing in through the back door and straight out the front.
Walter! No running in the house!
Kaufman took a slug of tea. His molars groaned. Too much sugar.
Must be tough with so many kids, he said.
She poured herself a second glass, spilled a drop on the coffee table, wiped it up with her wrist.
Oh, they're not all mine, thank God. The youngest belonged to Sally, my neighbor. She's working days now.
She gave a tight-lipped smile, made her look like a ventriloquist dummy.
I don't want to take too much of your time, Mrs. Glynn.
It's no problem.
I'm interested in Patrick's home team, the Patriots.
Boys, just fooling around.
What kind of fooling around?
You know, the usual monkey shines, getting into trouble, getting out of trouble.
Getting out of trouble and going off to war.
Mrs. Glynn stopped smiling.
War is a terrible thing, Mr. Koffler. Did you serve?
No, ma'am. 4F.
My husband's also 4F. He works in town. He's a guard at the post office.
4F's nothing to be ashamed of, Mrs. Glynn.
He's blind.
Kaufman's brow furrowed. This family was no Norman Rockwell portrait.
Pete was with the fire department,
she continued.
He was caught in a blaze.
Kaufman loosened his tie.
I'm sorry to hear that, Mrs. Glynn.
My husband's a good man. He's had a hard life. We all have.
He was spinning in a vortex of Glenn misfortune, mingled with a touch of his own.
Well, at least you have your Bradley home now.
Do you see him here, Mr. Koffler?
She poured another glass. Kaufman declined.
But you're right. At least he's back. And he's in one piece. Not like poor Johnny Reed. I went to the hospital with Carol. How she manages. First losing her husband, and now poor Johnny. When you see something like that, it's all you can imagine. I was so afraid for Bradley. Jimmy came back next, but I tell you, none of us were surprised. He always drank too much. Then, finally, my baby returned, and he was all right. He was in one piece. They sent him back with the Walsh boy. The word on Patrick wasn't so good at first. His skull was fractured, you know. But he seemed to be pulling through fine. And then, just like that, he's dead. And it wasn't even the Germans.
Nope, but he did get a medal because of them.
Right,
she scoffed.
I guess he deserved that. I don't know much about it, except what I've read in the papers. But it's a bit surprising, if you ask me.
How's that, Mrs. Glenn?
Kaufman calmly regarded her. He nestled his elbow in the lumpy arm of the chair and rested his cheek in his hand.
Well, he wasn't particularly respectful of people, Mr. Kaufler. People who were different. Bradley wasn't like that. Bradley was a good boy.
You're saying Patrick wasn't a good boy?
Does it really matter anymore? He's dead. He came back alive, and now he's dead. They both came back alive. Bradley.
A laugh erupted, then suddenly cut off.
And you were so thankful, thinking it's all over, that you can finally stop praying that everything will go back to normal. But it never does it, Mr. Kaufler?
She didn't want an answer. She wanted absolution. Kaufman leaned forward, spoke low.
Things happen, Mrs. Glenn. We do the best we can.
Now you're sounding like my husband.
She stood up swiftly.
I need to get dinner ready. I'm afraid you don't have much for your story. You're better off talking with Bradley.
She paused.
If you can.
Kaufman stood, held his hat with both hands.
Thank you for your time, Mrs. Glenn.
She walked him to the door.
If you do speak with my son, Mr. Kaufler, please.
What's that, Mrs. Glenn?
She looked at him, and the tension melted from her face.
Please tell him. Whatever happened, it's over. Please, just tell him to come home.
Chapter 9. It was dusk. Kaufman decided to hoof it. Not to save expenses, mind you, just needed to walk. He tramped along Eustace, didn't break the beat till he reached Cliff Walk. Then the sea reached out and slapped him across the face. He filled his lungs with the salted air and took a snort of pungent kelp. Sky and sea blended, slate blue. Down below, waves smashed against the jagged rocks of Easton's Beach. Cliff Walk twisted high above the rock face, eventually leading up the 40 steps and onto a narrower stretch, paralleling Ochre Point Avenue. A steeper drop-off. Mansions on one side, ocean on the other. Bronte land, without the moors. He ran his hand over the stones of the guard wall, feeling their cold hearts, stopped, and looked off into the distance. About 100 yards ahead, some fellow in a dark trench coat and wide-brimmed hat. He rested there, his back against the wall, curled his head down into cupped hands, a flare. He raised up and blew out a haze of smoke that melted into the fog. Kaufman sucked in his lower lip, bit down. Another patriot? Not likely. He flattened his hands on the stone wall. Clouds weighed down. A gull cried. He retraced his steps in his mind. There'd been an itch under his skin ever since he'd arrived. That creepy feeling, like somebody following you. He'd expected the haunting, but tossed it off as so many ghouls and ghosts, or just the unwelcomed sobriety. He turned away, began to walk, inched a glimpse behind. The trench was in step. Kaufman's face hardened, his hands tightened into fists. He began to walk more briskly. There was no one else around. He looked down. Well, he could spring a high dive, but he'd need at least a fifth to muster that. He cheated another glance. The guide sped his stride. Kaufman looked up. The embankment that led to the estates was at least twice his height, but it was better than being Esther Williams. He took a running leap, dug his fingers, and began to scramble. Looked back. The trench had broken into a sprint, coat fluttering like black wings. Kaufman tried to wedge a toe into a crag. If he'd worn gumshoes, it would have been a cinch. He grappled with the chiseled edges, knees scraping rock, slicing himself on the stones. Behind, a dark flurry closing in, speck of ember hovering in the shadow under the hat. Kaufman gritted his teeth, breath shooting out in short, hot spurts, dug his digits into a crevice and hauled himself up toward the lip. Wind shrieked, and a maniacal gust slammed him into the rock face, caught his fedora from behind and tore it from his scalp. The hat flew out over cliff walk, took a wide arc above the roiling sea, and began its descent, slowly spiraling down. Chapter 10. Across a rolling expanse of lawn was the estate, big and white. Kaufman took a moment to catch his breath, snuck another look behind. The trench popped up over the wall. Somehow, his hat remained in place. Kaufman dashed ahead. He had a decent lead on his shadow and wound his way through the topiary. Rose gardens, a marble fountain, snaking hedges of boxwood. A stabbing pain shot up from his right knee. But he didn't downshift, and he didn't look back. Kept racing for the mansion. A crystal glow spilled out the back through immense palazzo doors. He threw himself at those doors, pressed his wounded palms against the glass. Inside, black servants in starched uniforms cleared the residue off a large lace-clad table. One stately gentleman, standing by the entrance, caught sight of Kaufman and paraded toward the door.
"May I help you?"
he asked in a deep, mellifluous voice. Kaufman was too winded to speak, reeling from the pain bolting up his thigh.
"Somebody following."
The butler surveyed the acreage. Kaufman looked around himself. The sky was as dark as a purple shiner. The gardens menaced in silhouette. No sign of the trench, or its owner. Didn't mean he was safe. Kaufman turned back to the butler, a man of stature, noble, grave. His hooded eyes betrayed no emotion, and even looking at a white man, he didn't blink. Kaufman was about to clarify his urgency, when he spotted a woman crossing the doorway past the dining room. She wore a pleated skirt and pastel blouse, and tennis shoes. Maura Walsh. Kaufman's mouth opened, but nothing came out. He stepped back and looked up. There was the balcony, exactly as described, the balustrade firmly in place. He whirled around to the patio, half expecting to see a chalk outline on the pavement.
"Sir, I need to inform you that this is a private property."
Kaufman looked at the butler, then through the doors. Mara returned, this time with a young man in her arm. Kaufman had only seen him in newsprint, but there was no mistaking Bradley Glenn.
"Sir..."
The butler took a step forward.
"I'm sorry, I can't. Listen, my name's Koffler. I need to speak with someone."
He watched Mora and the Glen kid exit.
"You are speaking with me, Mr. Koffler."
"Yes, yes, I know, but maybe I could..."
He hung his head and exhaled a cloud of resignation. If he said too much, he'd blow the whole thing. The butler's mouth remained firm, but something in his eyes seemed to be weighing the situation, and Kaufman felt he might be coming up short.
"I cannot allow you in this way, with soil on your shoes, sir. If you'll step over to the side..."
He gestured to his left.
"You may enter through the kitchen."
Kaufman searched for signs of a tell. Nothing. He thanked the butler, and cautiously made his way to the side entrance. It was moments like these when he wished he carried a Colt. He waited outside for what seemed like hours, but was only about 4 minutes.
"Please, come in."
Stoneface was almost gracious. Kaufman stepped into a kitchen twice the size of his apartment in Providence. Coloreds bustled about cleaning pots and pans, chopping vegetables. They spoke in accents of the southern states and distant islands, their burnished skins glistening with sweat.
"This way, Mr. Koffler."
"Thanks. I was in a bit of a spot back there." Kaufman reached out his hand. The butler looked at him, turned on his heel.
"Of course you were, Mr. Koffler. Please, follow me."
Kaufman followed him, still hobbling from the flare-up in his hinge. They passed along a dim, narrow corridor, lined floor to ceiling with canned goods, and through a small vestibule into another hallway with a lower ceiling. They descended a half flight of steps and turned a corner into yet another hall.
"This must be the scenic route," Kaufman quipped.
"My apologies, sir. We're almost there."
The butler's stride remained constant. Then he stopped.
"This is the door."
"Thank you, Mr.
Harlow. Just Harlow."
"Thank you, Harlow."
Harlow nodded his head at a large door with thick iron latches. Kaufman still wasn't sure what to make of him. He grabbed the handle and stepped over the threshold. It took about 2 seconds before he realized he was back outside, in a parking lot. He heard the door close behind him and the unmistakable sound of a deadbolt. The next thing he heard was a siren. Chapter 11.
"Well, what do we have here?"
"Looks like somebody let a dog out of the pound."
"A mutt."
"A mongrel."
The two bulls snorted. Kaufman shook his head and raised his arms in the air.
"Well, if it ain't Laurel and Hardy, what do you got me for?"
"Trespassing, what do you think?"
sang Hardy. Laurel chimed in.
"But we could bring you down to the clubhouse. See what else sticks."
They winked and nudged each other. The bigger one's belly jiggled over his belt. His doughy fingers fondled a nightstick. The little one was about 2 sizes too small for his blues. Looked like some kid playing dress-up. He rocked back and forth on his heels, nodding his head like a demented pigeon. The head was narrow, elongated, as if someone had set it in a vise. Hattery and Trask. It would take some digging to find 2 worse cops on the beat.
"You boys are quick."
Hattery grinned.
"Yeah, we was just down at the pond, scouting for skinny dippers.
Then we got a call. Didn't expect to find you."
Trask certainly had the better sense of humor. "So you gonna put nippers on me?"
"You look pretty nipped already."
Hattery circled Kaufman, beaming a flashlight over his shredded suit. "I got in a little scrape."
"That's what happens with these dogs, Trask. They're much better behaved once they've been neutered."
"You ought to know, Hardy."
Hattery gave Kaufman a swift clip behind the ear with the lamp. Kaufman's face smacked the gravel.
"Serves me right for opening my yap," he mumbled into the ground.
"Frisk 'em, Trask. He might be packing."
"He got something inside his jacket here. What's that, Kaufman?" "That a gat?"
Trask yanked out the wallet.
"Could have fooled me."
"Perfect,"
Kaufman moaned.
"Hey, you like games, Kaufman?"
Hattery gave him a kick in the ribs for punctuation.
"Let's all try to guess how much scratch you got there. What do you think, Trask?"
"I say he got a sawbuck. What do you say, Kaufman?"
The smaller scumbag also gave him a kick.
"I got 2 kopecks and a groji,"
Kaufman answered. The cops examined the wallet. There actually was a sawbuck, and 2 20s. They divvied up the spoils.
I say he got nothing,
Hattery announced. He held the wallet open over Kaufman's head and let it drop.
What are you doing back in Newport, anyways?
Trask picked at a zit on his temple.
The force don't need some sniffer kike telling him what to do. Thought you learned your lesson. If I remember correctly, you got off easy on that one only because we thought we'd never have to see your ugly mug again.
Kaufman sat up. Back from my college reunion.
Ah, is that Jew you?
Trask laughed like a hyena, leaned against the squad car to catch his breath. Kaufman checked his ribs. Nothing critical. He put the empty wallet back in place. The show was basically over. The big guy squatted down in front of him, let out a vicious fart of rancid meat and onions.
I hope you ain't getting in the Walsh case, Kaufman. It's closed. Besides, no one wants you here. Not even your own peoples. What do you gotta prove?
Chapter 12. Fortunately, the Joy Boys gave him a lift down to the ferry dock. Couldn't have him desecrating Cliff Walk, for God's sakes. He thanked them cordially and waved goodbye. As soon as they were out of sight, he trotted back to town. He hadn't planned to stay in Newport more than the day. It wasn't far from Providence. But the case was moving on its own steam now, even if he didn't know exactly where it was going. He reached into his sock. Laurel and Hardy might have put a dent in his per diem, but he still had some cabbage stowed away. He counted the balance, a century, 250s, and some change. So much for playing the frugal Jew. He was going to spend the night in style. The Hotel Viking was as society as you could get without bedding down at the breakers. Kaufman slapped the C-note on the counter. Don't know how many nights. We can settle at checkout. A pasty-complected clerk took the bill and looked around for authorization. Night shift. He was on his own. Blood had trickled down the side of Kaufman's head and left a ring around his ear. His face was pocked with scratch marks. His raw fingertips banged a Gene Krupa rhythm on the counter as he stared the boy down. The clerk acquiesced.
I'll need you to sign the registration book.
Flipped it around to face Kaufman. Craned his neck to read as Kaufman scribbled.
Kaufman?
You got a problem with that?
Kaufman didn't look up. Scratched a line under his name and tossed the pen onto the counter.
No, I'm just... It's just...
I'll take the key.
Yes, here. Room 313. Do you have any baggage, Mr. Kaufman?
Plenty, but I'll carry it myself.
He scoped out the interior. In all his years in Newport, Kaufman had never even set foot in this place. Creamy satin drapes, Edwardian chandeliers, mohair lounges, and filigreed wallpaper. He faced the clerk again.
The bar open?
Sorry. We close at 10 on weekdays.
Good.
Kaufman flipped the key in the air, caught it underhand, and strode off to his room. 10:23. Time passes slowly when you're on the wagon. The ache in his ribs eclipsed any hunger, and his head was throbbing. He stood in front of an etched mirror over a rococo bureau. He looked like crap. He stripped and left the ruined clothes in a lump on the floor. Thought about washing the shirt by hand. Thought again. He drew a hot bath. Watched the water pour out of the brass spout and slowly fill the clawfoot tub. Then he climbed in and melted away. Chapter 13. It was late morning when Kaufman finally awoke. A slab of sun fell on his face from the parted window drapes. He covered his eyes with one hand, reached for the phone with the other. Only his arm wouldn't stretch. He cursed, inched himself up against the headboard, and tried again.
Front desk, how may we help you?
You got a bellhop?
Yes, sir, indeed we do.
Send him up to 313.
Gladly, sir. He'll be there in just a minute.
Swell.
He straggled into the bathroom. The bump on his head had turned into a mean little knot. He looked in the mirror. Could be worse, but he'd have to forgo shaving for a day or so to let the scratches heal. He became aware of a timid knocking, abandoned his reflection, and went over to the door.
You sent for a bellhop, sir?
The boy was clearly uneasy with Kaufman's ragged appearance. Or maybe it was just the boxer shorts.
What's your name, kid?
Gerald, sir,
he said in a powdery voice. Gerald had pale skin and thin hair meticulously combed and parted. He fidgeted with a brass button on his uniform jacket. His eyes shifted nervously everywhere but at Kaufman.
Okay, Gerald, I want you to go out and buy me a suit. 42 regular. Cuff the pants at 34 inches. If it comes with two pair of pants, even better.
And throw in a shirt. 16½ neck, 33 sleeve. Kaufman grabbed a bill off the nightstand and handed it over. I got 50 to spare. Keep the change. The kid reached for the note like it might jump up and bite him on the nose.
Sure. What color?
White.
White suit?
White shirt.
And, the suit?
Something nice. Summer weight. No stripes.
The boy didn't move. Looked up at the ceiling and tapped a tapered nail into the palm of his hand.
Need me to write it down?
No, sir. I've got it.
He pocketed the green. Took one look at Kaufman's face. One at his chest. And a quick one at the shorts. Tipped his cap and turned away.
Back in a jiffy,
he called over his shoulder.
And Gerald.
Yes, sir?
Bring me the receipt. What color is that? Brown?
It's called taupe. If you don't like it, sir, I can bring it back.
Nah, I like it. Classy.
And yet casual.
Kaufman took the suit by the hanger and held it up in front of him.
What's the tab?
35 for the suit. They had a Glen Plaid on sale, but it didn't seem appropriate.
Good call.
And the shirt was $3.50. English tailoring?
You're spoiling me.
Kaufman opened the shirt and began pulling out the pins.
The suits with two pants were atrocious. Synthetic fibers. I couldn't even touch them.
Nor should you. You did good, Gerald. What'd you get yourself?
The boy had a small package by his side. He was surprised Kaufman had noticed. He hadn't. He just knew.
A cardigan?
He began to take it out of the bag.
I know I should have just saved the money, but I do love the color. Goldenrod? It was a steal at $3. That still leaves almost 10 to bring home to Mother. She doesn't like me buying clothes. That's not usually a problem with what I make here, but every now and then I get a swell tip, and this was the swellest tip ever. What do you think?
The boy started to prance around the room in his new purchase. If Jewish kids got the shit beat out of them, what chance did this guy have?
I can take it from here, Gerald. Save the floor show for your mother.
The boy withdrew. Kaufman looked down, shook his wrist to wind his watch.
Yes, I'll...
Gerald stammered.
Well, thank you, sir, and I hope you have a pleasant stay at the Hotel Viking.
Kaufman flipped his tie into a Windsor. It was the only article left intact from the previous night. He'd forgotten to ask for a new one, but fortunately it matched the suit. It didn't look half bad. The scruff added an edge. Could come in handy. but right now he was hungry. He pocketed his key, placed a Do Not Disturb sign on the door, and journeyed downstairs to the dining room. Thought about eating on the terrace, but figured he should hold off the daylight a few minutes more. The maitre d' set him up in the corner anyway. Best not to alarm the other guests. Kaufman ordered a poached egg and toasted rye, declining coffee in favor of tea. Ran his hand through his hair, felt the bump. He now had more questions than he began with, and knew that further navigation would be a challenge. He could probably bide his time for a while, but the cops were wise, and whoever was under that hat and trench was wiser. Unless he wanted another change of wardrobe, he'd better keep a low profile. There weren't many diners, too late for breakfast, too early for lunch. Kaufman closed his eyes and let his ears receive the voices around the room. He soon fixed on a cultivated baritone and a rumbling bass. The baritone was far more talkative.
"Now, Tom, I'm not particularly interested in mixing politics with sport, but politics and liquor..."
"And cigars."
"There's a trinity for you."
Laughter. Kaufman opened his eyes. A couple of tables away sat two men of old money, locked in conversation. They looked almost identical. Dunny white hair swept back, pinched alabaster skin, neck folds resting on tight collars. The main differentiating factor was above their lips. One man had a pencil-line arch, giving him a permanent air of disdain. The other's mustache covered his mouth entirely, feral, yellowed along the edge, forced you to focus on the eyes, which were icy and cruel. The one with the thin mustache used his fork for emphasis as he talked. The other sat still, made only the most essential movements. Hand to cup, cup to mouth, tilt. He spoke next.
"So you'll venture up there after they've knocked some balls about?"
"Tea off was at 9. They'll finish by noon, then cocktails, then lunch. I'll plan to arrive before cocktails and leave before lunch. The Irish are so coarse, dining with them would be sheer torture."
He blotted his lips and the thin line above them.
"Might miss some action on the green."
"It's just foreplay. Besides, all that counts is my signature."
"And his investment."
They laughed again. The one with the walrus face was wiping his lip brush and rising from the table. He patted his compatriot on the shoulder. His deep voice dropped further.
"Can you cover breakfast, Tom? I left my wallet in the limo."
The inequity of it all."
Pencil raised his hands and wriggled a set of slender fingers.
"Well, Victor, looks like we'll be doing dishes again for our keep."
Walrus placed a derby squarely on his head, made the sign of the cross over his associate.
"Go in peace, my son, and give my regards to Clayton and the senator."
"What? Did the whole town revolve around Clayton Walsh?"
Kaufman's egg arrived as he was watching the one named Victor make his exit. He ate it in two bites and clamped the toast together in a jelly sandwich, knocked back the tea and signaled for the waiter, charged the meal to his room and bolted. He may have missed the tea off, but maybe he could still catch a couple of holes. But first, a haberdashery. Hats are personal. You don't send errand boys out for them. There was a spot on Bellevue with a few decent pieces in the window.
"Ah, the enigmatic chap in gabardine."
A spectacled salesman sallied over, gave him the up and down, circled twice.
"Nice fit. Splendid."
He pulled Kaufman's cuff down onto his shoe.
"Could use a polish."
Kaufman stepped back. "I just need a hat." The clerk was delighted. He waved his arm in front of a wall aligned with fedoras. Kaufman half expected them to jump off the shelves and launch into a Busby Berkeley routine. He got out as quickly as he could, to the tune of $4.50. Not bad for a dusty Borsellino. He fit the hat at an angle. If the guy had called it a chapeau one more time, he would have decked him. He hailed a taxi at Memorial. Likely he'd been tagged at Horizon House by now. How could Laurel and Hardy resist? And Clayton would have all the background he needed on the Shabbos Seamus. Whether Mara had heard the dirt, Kaufman couldn't say. He had a number for her at work, some summer volunteer project, but best to wait till he'd checked in with Goldie. It was 10:45 a.m. The game would be in full swing, so to speak. He handed the cabbie a 5-spot. Chapter 14. Kaufman walked up the driveway and went directly to the side entrance where Harlow had chumped him the night before. It was open. He slipped in and made his way along the narrow corridors to the kitchen. Could smell fresh bread cooking in the oven. A servant was hunched over the sink, another rummaging around the pantry. Kaufman slunk along the wall unnoticed and out the back door. The hedges were a tad shorter than they'd appeared by night. Kaufman crouched down and scurried behind them. At the far end of the grounds, he could make out 7 men, some swinging clubs. As he got closer, he saw they had multiple tees and were simply smacking balls over the bluff. Not particularly competitive. Wondered what the par would be. He moved in tighter. They weren't all players, only a foursome. Harlow presided over a drink cart. Another servant held a bag of clubs. A smaller gentleman in a dark suit paced off to the side. The golfers were decked out in classic country club wear, tams and tartans, spiked two-tones gripping the soil. Of the four, only one had good form. He twirled his driver between strokes, wandered over to the bar for a drink, holding his glass aloft. Another man shouted, 4, and they all lined up and volleyed in unison. The dimpled orbs sailed up into the air and plummeted down to the ocean.
"Sorry I'm late, gents."
Harlow almost dropped the martini he was mixing. He gazed at Kaufman open-mouthed.
"Clayton, fine form as usual."
Kaufman stepped up to the one with the perfect swing and thrust out his hand. The man shifted the wood to his left and reciprocated the shake. Kaufman couldn't resist giving him a pat on the back as he turned to the butler.
"How you doing, Harlow? Lovely weather, ain't it?"
Harlow's mouth closed and he formed his words precisely.
"It is a veritable golfer's paradise, Mr. Kaufman."
He exchanged a knowing look with Clayton.
"I bumped into Victor at brunch at the Viking. Love the Eggs Benedict. Heard you boys were playing through and had to at least stop by to meet the senator. And glad you did, Moses."
Clayton was clearly a team player.
"Mitchell Shaughnessy, Moses Kaufman.
Pleased to meet you, Mitch."
The senator looked somewhat perplexed. Clayton gave a toothy smile.
"And I don't believe you met our new city councilman, Casey Phelan."
Casey Phelan was middle-aged, but had a strangely boyish face. Wore it like a creepy Halloween mask. Kaufman leaned into him and whispered,
"Couldn't help noticing you got a bit of a slice there, Casey. Try to strengthen your grip. Close your stance a smidgen. See where that takes you."
"Thank you, Moses."
The councilman was pleased.
"Call me Mo."
Clayton was still smiling, held his driver lightly from the grip and swung it back and forth.
"And this is Cyrus Doyle, a business associate from Texas."
The largest of the men took Kaufman's hand and held it firm.
"So, how's our friend, Victor?"
he drawled.
"Fit as a fiddle, except for some yolk on his stash."
Kaufman rubbed a finger over his upper lip. Doyle chuckled and released his hand, glanced over at Walsh, who remained calm, no doubt aided by the skillful blending of gin and vermouth. Kaufman surveyed the assembly. The man in the suit had stopped his pacing and stood staring at him. He tugged at the cuffs of his freshly pressed shirt, rubbing them fiercely between his thumbs and forefingers.
"Ah, I'm sorry, Mo,"
Walsh smirked.
"This is my attorney, Ben Horner."
Kaufman loped over to Horner. crooked an arm around his rigid shoulders and addressed the committee.
"Four mix, two coloreds, and a Jew," Kaufman announced. "If the game were seven-card stud, you'd have a winning hand."
Horner's legs almost buckled. Walsh shook his head, leaned over on his club, and then began to laugh. A huge belly laugh. It rippled into the earth and spread out to each member of the team, up their spikes, over their argyles, through their patterned pants, and into their gullets. In one voice, they all began to convulse. The councilman hopped on the train.
"Good one, Mo. Say, why don't you join us for cocktails?"
As they paraded across the backfield of Horizon House, Kaufman had the distinct feeling that Harlow was aiming a 9-iron for his head. Walsh was leading the way. His entire bearing had a bestial quality. Massive shoulders crowded his neck. The calf muscles below his knickers bulged with thick blue veins. He moved with long, powerful strides, graying hair flowing back, wild, mane-like. He turned back to the others.
"Why don't you boys clean up at the clubhouse and meet Mo and me in the study? Harlow will make sure the ice doesn't melt."
He kept a jovial tone, but his voice was as gravelly as a cement mixer.
"You know, I expected to see Bradley Glenn around," Kaufman called out.
His new best friend, the councilman, responded,
"Oh, Bradley doesn't play much anymore."
"He's probably in the study, but I'm sure he'll be delighted to see you."
Walsh gave a curt nod to Harlow, who abandoned the booze cart and breezed ahead into the house. Kaufman looked behind. Only the caddy and Ben Horner were left to bring up the rear. The caddy because he had a heavy load. Horner because he was a schlemiel. Kaufman realized that the servant with the clubs was the only one he hadn't been introduced to. Did Walsh even know the boy's name? As the other golfers veered off to the clubhouse, Kaufman lagged behind. He patted Ben Horner on the back.
"Tell your boss I'm just going to tag along to the locker room. Gotta drain my schmeckle."
Before Horner could protest, Kaufman had joined the pack. When he arrived at the study, the other men were waiting, plus two. Bradley Glenn was seated in a leather Chesterfield, swirling a whiskey and soda. Next to him, Old Man Tom from the Viking Breakfast, the one with the trim mustache. Both had their beads on Kaufman. So did Walsh, over by the bar. Kaufman knew his time was limited. He made a beeline for the boy.
"Bradley Glenn, name's Mo Kaufman."
"From what I understand, your name's Mud."
"Good one, soldier. I'd just like to..."
"You got a lot of moxie,"
Ben Horner intercepted, pressing Kaufman into the corner.
"But every ounce of it'll be wrung out of you, so help me God."
"Whose God is that, my Sephardic friend?"
"Don't play the tribe game with me,"
Horner snapped like a rabid terrier.
"We have absolutely nothing in common."
"You can say that again."
Kaufman spoke from the corner of his mouth.
"The only species you'd have in common are invertebrates."
Horner's little eyes blinked behind his wire rims. His face grew red.
"Martini's coming up, gentlemen!"
Walsh reclaimed the floor. He whipped out a stainless steel shaker.
"What's your poison, Mo?"
And it had all been going so smoothly. But before Kaufman could squeeze out a snappy answer, Harlow was at the door.
"Phone call for you, Mr. Kaufman."
Kaufman looked at Harlow. Harlow looked back at Kaufman.
"Why, Harlow, just tell them I'm busy."
Harlow's eyes narrowed ever so slightly.
"I'm afraid it's urgent, Mr. Kaufman. Something about your mother."
He aced it, that Harlow. Hole in one.
Kaufman could spot a sneer on Walsh's face. He excused himself and dutifully followed the servant out of the room. and down the hall, and down another hall, and along a corridor, and into the kitchen, where Harlow turned to him and said,
"I believe, Mr. Kaufman, you know the way from here."
Chapter 15. Kaufman stepped out onto the driveway. He didn't expect any cops, at least not this time. Too much of a scene, too many questions. For some of these guests, Kaufman was a stand-up guy, if not a stand-up goy. Walsh he'd never win over, but he didn't have to. For all intents and purposes, he'd crashed the green. Now all he had to do was stick it out for 18 holes. He took another look at Horizon House. When he turned back to the street, a car was heading straight for him. Not just any car. A fire-red Delahaye T-165. Impressive. Still, he preferred not to become a hood ornament. Kaufman was just about to make another dive for the gravel when the roadster screeched to a halt.
"Get in!"
Mara ordered, and he complied. She gunned the engine, and they peeled out onto Ochre Point. For a college kid, she sure knew how to handle a clutch.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
"Just my job, missy." Kaufman held onto his Borsellino. He was beginning to grow fond of the fedora and wasn't quite ready to part with it. Mara hooked a right on Ruggles and an immediate left onto Bellevue. Her lightly waxed lips were tightly set. Hazel eyes shaded, squinting behind green lenses.
"You weren't supposed to confront Clayton until I gave the word."
"Didn't quite work out that way. Want a refund?" The speedometer was hovering at 90. The Astor's Beechwood Bastion flew by.
"You don't know Clayton. He's dangerous."
She slapped the wheel with a kid-gloved hand.
"They all are."
"They might not be the best golfers, but dangerous?"
"Don't patronize me."
She stomped on the accelerator. The road jerked to a right angle at Rough Point. She swerved at the last second and followed Bellevue over to Ocean Drive. Kaufman began to sweat, the cold kind. "I'm not particularly keen on dying in a car," he said. "Tried it once. Nothing to recommend. Besides, it's a waste of gas rations." She sucked in her lips, downshifted to a comfortable 40, swept the hair out of her face and looked over at him, slipping off the shades. Her eyes were red, frantic.
"You're supposed to be helping me."
"Don't worry, kid, I am." "So, who tipped you off?"
"Harlow."
"Thought he was Clayton's man."
"Well, you thought wrong."
She replaced the shades. "So you knew I was there last night?"
"After the fact. Harlow was just trying to protect me."
"I could have used some protection myself. I was being tailed."
"Damn it!"
She hit the wheel again, jumped to 60.
"That's why I wanted you to hold your fire. You've got to be prepared with Clayton. You've got to have something on him so he can't touch you. Then you can do whatever you want."
She stopped carping, eased off the accelerator.
"Who was following you?"
"Don't know. Some chap in a trench coat. Hat pulled down. Couldn't get a fix on the face."
"I don't know who that is. I don't like it."
"Neither do I." He studied her carefully. "Papa Walsh, have you tracked?"
"Not that I know of."
"But he could." She swiveled the rearview mirror, looked behind. The road was empty. "Maybe somebody pegged me when I landed," Kaufman said. "Anyway, thanks to Harlow, cops are on my tail, and your dad has my vitals." The corner of her mouth lifted.
"That's some kind of progress, I guess."
"Hey, proves I'm working." He watched the steel-blue waves of Bailey's Beach curl in frothy billows. Sunburnt boys body surfed, arms outstretched like Superman.
"So, what have you got?"
she asked. "I can tell you that whatever happened to your brother, he probably deserved it." she scoffed.
That's old news. I thought you were working.
I've talked with Jimmy Fry, Bradley Glenn's ma, been chased, beat up, and joined a golf team. That's not enough.
Bradley's mom?
Yeah. I was hunting down the kid. She's not the happiest homemaker. Misses her boy. Mara flinched.
He's been living at Horizon House.
I know. Funny you didn't think to clue me in.
He doesn't know anything.
You want me to have more ammunition? I need the goods about Dora Middlebow. If Patrick's Purple Heart was a sham, it'd give me leverage over both Glenn and your dad.
Bradley won't talk.
He might if I cornered him.
He can't.
She yielded a little.
I mean, he won't. I've been trying to get him to talk about it since he came back. He's all buttoned up.
That's the war.
He was like that before the war. Quiet. Then he just got quieter.
The Delahaye clung to the road. They cruised past King's Beach and around Brenton Point. In the distance, the Castle Hill Lighthouse kept a lone guard on the bay. Kaufman started to squirm, sinking down in his seat. Sweats came again, beaded up on his forehead. He put out his arms and flattened his hands against the dash. She looked over at him.
I'm sorry about Bradley.
It's not Bradley, he said, his voice hollow. Listen, we had to blow this route. Cut up Winans, will you? She swung a right, leaving the lighthouse behind. Kaufman removed his hat, mopped his face with his handkerchief. Mara slowed down.
Are you all right? I'm going the speed limit.
He sloughed it off. Nah, it's lighthouses. They give me the jimmies. Kaufman focused ahead. The Newport Country Club spread out before them like a demi-Versailles. Manicured turf, green as a fresh dollar bill.
What do you say about lunch?
She asked. I could abide.
My treat.
She sped up the private drive and swerved to a stop by a pimply-faced valet. Made him jump out of his Oxfords. Didn't think they allowed Jews. Kaufman hopped out, came around and opened her door before the kid had the chance.
They don't, but you're with me.
She tossed the boy the keys.
No Irish either. But we change that.
Well, what do you know? Our time is up. That's it then for episode 2 here on Sunday Night Noir. Kaufman's Holiday, chapters 8 through 15. And if, God forbid, you miss any episode, for 5 weeks at least, they'll be in the archives. Where, you may ask? Well, right here. On Radio Free Brooklyn. By the way, all the folks at the station and myself really appreciate it when you contribute to the cause. Just go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. You can even give directly to Sunday Night Noir. It's called a sponsorship. This is Matt Mittler signing off, but I'll be back. You'll hear me coming, my floor chimes clacking on the cobblestones.